Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're having a wonderful Saturday. My name is Tim Andrews. I am your host. You can hear me normally Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. on the Von Hessler Doctrine. We have an action-packed show today, jam-packed with guests and all sorts of fun topics from wrestling to anime. My guest later on in the program is Brad Bellucci, and he has a brand new book out called The Six-Pack, On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. And he'll talk about, well, we're going to go back to December of 1983 when the Iron Sheik defeated Bob Backlund, setting up the next 40 years of wrestling sports entertainment. But first, April 15th is National Anime Day. What is anime? It's the Japanese animation that has exploded in popularity over the, well, I would say quite a while, and it has impacted nearly every single aspect of American pop culture. And you know what? I think it's time for me to open my brain and find out as much as I can about anime, because in a couple of weeks, well, sometime next month, actually, MomoCon, which is a celebration of anime, gaming, comics, and animation, is coming to Atlanta at the Geek Culture Convention Center in Atlanta. Anyway, we'll find out more about that later. Let's not keep my guests waiting. We have Leah President and Alec Murray, and you guys are podcast hosts. Crunchyroll, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct. And like you said, Anime Day is coming up on the 15th. We're trying to overcome tax day.
Yeah,
make it a little brighter, a little more fun.
Right. So tell us, first off, tell me about Crunchyroll Presents The Anime Effect. I want to know about the podcast, because I was looking at it on YouTube. You got millions of followers, which means you're getting lots of ears and lots of eyeballs. How exciting is that?
Oh, it's absolutely exciting, because like, we love being able to interact with the community, and the podcast is the perfect way for us to do that. So on The Anime Effect, it's all about, not only are we, you know, talking through anime news, but we're also going to interact with the fans, whether it's through recommendations or through us answering the mailbag question. Mm-hmm. And us being able to meet every kind of fan where they are, whether they're starting out, whether they're in the middle, whether they're already down the rabbit hole. Like, we, you know, we've got something for everybody on the show.
So let me ask you a question. Is the movie Akira considered to be an anime movie? Because that's my reference, point of reference.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
Okay, good.
And, you know, it's funny you bring it up, because if we're talking about how anime is penetrating, you know, pop culture and growing out of a niche, Jordan Peele actually references Akira in some of his work. Mm-hmm. You know, we call it the classic Akira slide, which is, you know, like the motorcycle slide where you turn on a dime and do a full stop. So,
That's
yeah,
great.
Definitely we claim Akira for sure.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, most recently, I guess in my realm of pop culture, Ghost in the Shell, which originally was animated, was a movie that came out a couple years ago with Scarlett Johansson, permeating and getting out into the culture with the movies like The Matrix and Kill Bill and even Avatar, are all influenced to some degree by anime. What is the current most popularly, like, if there are people out there who have kids who are watching anime, what's the most popular thing right now?
The most popular thing right now, are you talking specifically like just within the medium or just
within the medium? Yeah. What's the thing now that everybody talks about? Is it a show? Is it a movie?
Oh, it could be multiple things at one time right now.
Okay.
There's so many popular shows, because the thing with anime is that within the medium, there's so many wide sweeping genres.
Yes.
But, you know, we have, you know, Jujutsu Kaisen, which was a really popular one. People were really talking about, mm-hmm. Was activating a lot of people. Demon Slayer was activating a lot of people. Shows like Dragon Ball and Naruto are always a part of the zeitgeist of, you know, anime or pop culture. Even to, you know, where you see like Michael B. Jordan references it in a lot of his films.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Guillermo del Toro, who is, you know, widely inspired by anime and animation, does that in his films as well. Even to, you know, athletes who are putting it on their gear, or if their walkout attire has something to do with it, right? So it really depends on, you know, what people are watching, because the fandom is wide sweeping, and it could just, you know, honestly just pop up anywhere.
Yeah, even into things like music. For example, Megan Thee Stallion. Everyone knows Ariana Grande. They talk about how anime influences their art forms. They've got anime tattoos. You know, it's becoming less of, you know, a niche and something that I think people can really connect to, no matter, you know, what genre you're into.
I think it's funny that you mentioned Megan Thee Stallion, because in the show notes, in the prep notes that I got, it says hip hop superstar Megan Thee Scallion. And I thought maybe she was sort of an anime tribute to Megan Thee Stallion. It does. I'm looking at it right now.
A green onion parody.
Right. So if you're out there, is this a multi-generational art form? Because I know Akira came out a long, long, long time ago. So we're talking 2-3 generations of people who have been consuming anime, and now it's just absolutely mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. It's again, I want to use Dragon Ball as the example here. You know, for me being, you know, part of the millennial set, Dragon Ball was something that we really, really grew up with, specifically Dragon Ball Z.
Right.
But then you have generations after us that are also following it because it's a classic, it's been around, you know, their brothers, sisters, or, you know, their parents are, you know, watching or rewatching it, and they're being exposed to it.
Right.
So it's something that just hops across the generations. And as the medium continues to grow, I think we're going to start seeing more and more and more of that, because fans are starting to absorb stuff that is all encompassing, right? Whether they want to watch an action show or, you know, a cooking based anime, or, you know, more of a family type, you know, feel good kind of anime. So I feel like it's just going to continue to evolve and grow, and the fandom is going to continue to push that momentum as well.
And now we live in an era where anybody can create their own content. Anybody can put a podcast out there, or anybody can create their own show. All it needs is a little push. You know, obviously I said earlier that you guys have a huge following on YouTube and probably all over the podcast universe. Where does anime go from here? Because it seems like it's permeated the culture so much. And again, I'm telling you that I'm old and I'm interested in it now, and I want to seek it out, because I love that beautiful colors, the bright animation. I've been watching cartoons my whole life. Where do you see it going moving forward in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so if you want to talk about how anime is, you know, growing out of a niche into mainstream pop culture, you can compare it to something like the NFL. Whether fortunately or unfortunately, I am a member of the Gen Z generation.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with Gen Zers. I am not someone who knocks Gen Z.
For sure. Yeah. But, you know, in my generation, about 25% only of Gen Z watch the NFL, interact with it, but around 42% say that they watch anime weekly. And that's coming from a recent study that came out through Polygon.
Wow.
So it's becoming, the momentum is definitely picking up. And I think because there is something for everyone, and, you know, it's as simple as, you know, sitting down and clicking play on Crunchyroll and figuring out like what you're into. And that's what we like to do on the podcast too, is, you know, whether you have never interacted with anime and just want to know what's up, or if you're a lifetime fan, you know, we'll meet you where you're at, and we'll find recommendations for you, ways for you to join the community.
Right. Do you do the festival circuit? Do you go out to these cities where they have the big conventions and do your podcast live and talk to the people that are there and some of the guests?
We're definitely hoping to expand into that. I think, you know, even before I worked in anime, I definitely went to conventions. Because I think one of the big things about anime is the community.
Yes.
And we really like to keep that on our show as well, is that community aspect and interacting with our community, answering questions, making sure people know there are no dumb questions to ask.
Yeah.
And really opening that door to more people, you know, loving this medium.
Well, I got to tell you, you've answered my dumb questions and made sure to let me know they're not dumb questions. And that's really, I mean, I really wanted to have you on because it's fascinating to me, and I host a pop culture show. I think my generation has kids. You got to know, and you got to experience yourself. I'm an old school geek. So like I said, I've been watching animated stuff for a very long time. April 15th is National Anime Day. And I want everybody to remember that. You also go check out Crunchyroll Presents The Anime Effect. I've been speaking with Leah President and Alec Murray. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for taking time to educate an old man like me about anime.
No worries. Thanks for having us on.
It was great, man. Thank you so much.
Can you learn an awful lot about anime in 10 minutes? I think I just did. I think there's a lot to explore. And you can find out more by checking out the Crunchyroll Presents The Anime Effect podcast, which you can get at crunchyroll.com. All right, hold on to your seats, because guess what? My next guest on the show, this is the author's second big book. His first book was called The Wax Pack, On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife, where he went and met former Major League Baseball players talking about nostalgia, sports, the human connection. And that's what he's doing in his current book. It's called The Six Pack, On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. Brad Baluchian spent an awful lot of time with the Iron Sheik and decided to write a book about the events that took place in December of 1983. Longtime WWE champion Bob Backlund was defeated by the Iron Sheik. Not very long after that, the Iron Sheik fell to Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea, thus giving birth to Hulkamania. And the rest, as they say, is history. Brad and I spoke for a long time, so you're going to get a little piece of it here. And then on Monday, when the podcast comes out, you can download and hear the entire unedited interview. Don't go away. Brad Baluchian is next on the Popcast with Tim Andrews on 95.5 WSB. Brad Baluchian, author of The Six Pack, On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. Welcome to the Popcast, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
I'm glad to have you. Let's begin with the story of the book. I mean, there's a lot in here to digest. It's not just, oh, look, you know, we're going to talk about the Iron Sheik. No, there's a whole bunch. There's some great stories in here, and it's an amazing tale, especially if you're a wrestling fan. What is the theme, though, of the book and the goal that you set for yourself that inspired you to write this book?
Well, I'd say the overall theme is a look at myth versus reality and identity through pro wrestling. So it's taking a set of guys that were on the show when the Iron Sheik became the champion back in 1983, and in 2022, going on a massive road trip to track them all down and to tell the story of to what extent each of them became or didn't become their characters, you know, and how much they were able to retain their true identity. So, for example, Hulk Hogan, his real name is Terry Bollea, guy from Port Tampa, Florida. So I traveled to Port Tampa, found the house he grew up in, met his childhood friends and the people that he was in a band with before wrestling, and really tried to tell that story of, you know, who he was before he was famous and before he was Hulk Hogan, and then who he is now and to what extent he's gone back to being who he was before.
Yeah,
and there's also a go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it's hard to get an authentic biography of Hogan, especially when he's telling you the past. So it must be daunting to go and try to find that yourself.
Right. And that's one of the points of this book is to talk to a lot of different people, a lot of different sources to fact check what's been told or what we think is the truth through the conventional narrative and to go to outside sources. And I mean, I'm a scientist in my other life, so I have that training to test hypotheses and to collect evidence and to try to, you know, get to the truth of whatever it is that I'm investigating. And I also have this backstory with the Iron Sheik, where I knew him many years ago. He was my favorite wrestler as a kid and was going to collaborate on a book with him years ago, but that didn't work out. But then on this road trip, I go to try to track him down again many, many years after I had worked with him previously, and tell the story of Khosrow Vaziri, who has got a fascinating life beyond the Iron Sheik identity, and having grown up in Iran and having been friends with this folk hero, this amateur wrestling star in Iran that died under mysterious circumstances, which led to Khosrow Vaziri defecting to the United States in 1969 and eventually becoming the Iron Sheik.
Yeah, you talk about that quite a bit and how interesting it is to know his background. And we'll get to this in a minute, and you talk about it in the book, how he always said he won a gold medal in the Olympics for Iran. But more to him coming to the United States. But before that, he was actually working for the Shah and his wife. He was sort of a bodyguard for them, or was a bodyguard for them.
That's right. When American dignitaries would come to Iran to visit, you know, in the 1960s, up until the late 70s, Iran and the U.S. had a pretty good relationship, and the Shah was very tight with the American leadership. And so when people would come to visit the Shah, there was a whole retinue of bodyguards, and Khosrow Vaziri, the Iron Sheik, was one of them, and particularly for the Shah's wife, Faha Pahlavi, he had a big role there.
Yeah, and the only time it was really there was a little bump in the road before the 70s was when we ousted Mossadegh.
Well, right. Well, that was something that, you know, that was a covert op in 1953 by Eisenhower that the general public
in
the U.S. didn't know about. So That's the thing. I get into the geopolitics behind the whole Iron Sheik, Iron Sheik, Hulk Hogan feud, and kind of explain, okay, yes, you know, back in that time, just this guy's from Iran, therefore he's a bad guy. But here's why in Iran there was this hostility towards the U.S. and sort of showing their side of it, you know, that we haven't really heard much about before.
Now, you got into wrestling. How old were you when you started watching it? Did you just accidentally catch it? Do you remember the first time?
Yeah, I was about 5 or 6, and it was, I actually watched, I saw the cartoon first, the Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling cartoon, and my mom, in a move she probably regrets to this day, said, oh, that's actually based on a real live-action thing. and then I found out, oh, Saturday Morning Wrestling, and here we are, I'm 43, and still just finished watching WrestleMania last night.
You're about the same age as my little brother. I'm 53, and he got into wrestling, had all the figures and stuff, but by the time those figures came out, I think I was a little too old, or I was like, I don't want any of these things. But I bought him later in life, you know, because you never really grow up when you're a nerd. But I remember that one night my mom's friends would come, you know, and they'd bring their kids and they'd go out, you know, and it was late on a Friday night, and the kid that was there was older than me, because you want to watch wrestling, and I'd never watched it before, and it was almost instantaneous. I was hooked. And this was the era when Hulk Hogan wore, I think, white or gray shorts, and he was a bad guy, and Freddie Blassie was his manager, and then he just disappeared.
Yeah.
And then you didn't know then, because all we got was WWF. That's because we lived near New York. We didn't get AWA. Sometimes they showed it on ESPN, I think. And we didn't get TBS until about 81, and that's when you started seeing, you know, the other leagues. But until that time, I thought it was all WWE or F or whatever. And my favorite wrestler at the time was Ivan Putski, but it was just an amazing thing. And then up until, I would say, about 2005, I stuck with it. And not because I don't want to watch it, it's just that it just became too much, you know, life gets in the way. But yeah, I was pretty much addicted to it, and I love hearing you be so reverent about it, you know, like it was an important part of your life, and you really believe it when you're reading the book.
Well, that's good. I want that, hopefully that comes across, that I have an incredible amount of respect for what these guys did and what they do, and find the whole subject fascinating, of where wrestling came from and why it's popular. And that's why in the book I got into the history of it a little bit, and talked to some academics who study its popularity and really try to understand that.
And part of this, now I got all excited yesterday and sent you a screen grab because I was doing some research on the first.
Oh, right.
Yeah. From in 1983. Now this was about 11 months before Sheik beat Bob Backlund. And by the way, I did not like Bob Backlund back then. I thought he was corny, and I would root for whoever he was wrestling to defeat him. I was like, he's such a goody-goody guy, and I like all these guys who are on the fringe or are really bad. But I got to go see it, and it was in a high school gym in a town called Elmira, New York. I don't know if you've ever heard of that town.
Sure, I have, yeah.
A couple of prisons there, and you know, Mark Twain is buried there, so there you go. But going to see that, my friend Stu punched Magnificent Morocco as he was walking into the ring. That's one of the memories.
Bad idea.
Yeah, I know. He turned around and he saw that he was a little kid, and he just kept walking. And then that night, Snuka defeated Ray Stevens. We got to see Superfly, and this was shortly after he stopped being the crazed man from wherever he was from, and he was actually a person. That night he got arrested, and you read it in the paper the next day, and that's when it crashed down. Oh, these are real people. They do things. He like got in a fight with a cop, and he was abusive and something like that. But I'm bringing that all up because I met him later in life. I was a restaurant manager. Snuka came in. He was a jobber by then. I don't think he was recognized by, you know, Vince of the WWE, but he came in, sat down, and ate. He couldn't have been a nicer person, and I'm bugging him. I was in my 20s, and I'm bugging him like a little kid. So my overall point, as I'm rambling here, is that these guys are hardworking dudes, and no one took care of them until when? The 2000s? And they were always just human beings, you know, and continuing to work.
Well, yeah, I don't know that anyone, even in the 2000s, is really taking care of them because, I mean, yes, their schedule is not as crazy as it used to be, and right. They have some more protections, but they're still classified as independent contractors.
Still.
They have no union. They have no retirement. They have no health insurance. Yeah. I mean, even to this day, it's crazy that the custodian at WWE has health care and Roman Reigns does not.
Yeah, that's insane. That's insane. So are they allowed to go? Well, we'll talk about it. Because we're coming up on when we're going to take a break, but it'll lead me to what I want to talk to you about next. You know, that short experience I had with Jimmy Snuka, you know, eating his pancakes at Bob Evans and chain smoking while he was eating. You bring up one of the first people other than Sheik that you talk about in the book is Tony Atlas, and just how human he is and how relatable he could be to anybody outside of the sport just based on who he is. So.
Right. And so Tony Atlas, a guy that before he was 12 had dealt with more adversity than probably you and I in our lives combined.
Yeah.
Just from growing up in the South in the 50s in Western Virginia in deep poverty. I mean, to the point where he was defecating in a box under the bed because they didn't have a proper toilet. His father ran out on the family. And then it was so bad that the state took him away from his mom because they deemed her unfit, and he was in a boys' home essentially for 4 years and told me that he had to fight every day to not get raped in the home. So, I mean, that's all as in childhood. So it's just amazing what some of these people dealt with. And then you throw in, we often forget whether it's athletes or wrestlers that they're achieving this incredible level of fame at such a young stage in their life. You know, they're in their early 20s, mid 20s, and they've got so much power and celebrity that it's almost impossible to not crash and burn with that.
Right.
And especially when you don't have the resources to know how to take care of yourself and manage your money. So yeah, we get into a lot of that in the book of someone like Tony Atlas, who just had a lot very early on and came to, you know, ran into a lot of trouble soon after.
He ran into a lot of adversity, but he kept going. So let's take
there's a full circle aspect to this book where, because I'm talking to these guys now in their 60s and 70s, and they've been through a lot, but most of them have come out to be pretty well adjusted, although, you know, their bodies are certainly pretty broken down, and that's there's no way to reverse the clock on that one. But just the pounding that it takes being in the ring for all those years.
Yeah, and that's another thing that they don't have they don't have a health plan, apparently. You know, one of the things you learn is that when they got picked up by a territory back in the day, or they get picked up by a promoter, they had to get themselves there, and they had to rent their own cars, right, and get their own hotel room. So everything just came out of pocket, and then whatever the purse was is what they took home. And I can't imagine that the purse was that much more than the expenses they paid to get there. So it was a labor of love if you wanted to do it, right?
Yeah, even the top guys weren't often on top for very long. So maybe you made really good money for like 2 or 3 years, but after that, you know, it's back to, like you said, barely scraping by.
And last night, I believe it was on Peacock, was WrestleMania 40. And I can't believe that it's been 40 years since the first WrestleMania. It just makes me feel older and older. The last one I saw was WrestleMania 30, because it was here, I believe, in Atlanta. It was either 30 or 31, I can't recall. But one of those, I got to meet Jimmy Hart and a whole bunch of guys, because I worked in morning radio, and we had a booth there during Media Row. So they all came by, and it was a blast. But to see guys that, in WrestleMania 40, that are still working. Now, The Rock obviously has his own thing outside of wrestling, and it's cool to see him come back and take a heel role. But then you see guys come into the ring like The Undertaker. Not spoiling it, I hope, for anybody, but The Undertaker shows up. Undertaker, to me, seems like a guy that hopefully saved his money, because what is he doing outside of wrestling?
Yeah, I do think that this generation of that the Undertaker and John Cena and those guys that are, they're veterans now, but I think they're pretty well off. I think that there were changes that were made in the business and overall that, that better set them up for a longer, you know, a longer life. But the era that I was writing about in the book, which is really guys from the 80s, very few of them are in great financial shape. I mean, I think someone like Hulk Hogan has, he's had his severe ups and downs, but right. he's actually doing fine because of his lawsuit against Gawker. but these guys, you know, they weren't trained how to manage their money either. And I'm heartened to see that. It's heartening to see that in the WWE, I know they do some training courses now, and they have resources for their talent to learn how to manage money and how to plan for life after wrestling. I mean, it, you know, WWE is a major publicly traded, you know, $8 billion corporation now, which is far from what it was in 1983 or 82, rather, when Vince bought it from his father, Vince McMahon. So I think it's come a long way, and I think that's all. Those are all positive changes, but there's still a lot of reform that could be done in that industry to help their talent.
And now, if you were a fan back in 1983, I don't know that that was on TV live. It might have been regionally. I don't remember. I know I saw the match after it because I couldn't believe that somebody had finally beaten Bob Backlund. But do you know? Do you remember? I'm just curious.
Yeah, there was no live TV except maybe like some of the Madison Square Garden shows may have been, but right. very little, if at all, back then. Yeah.
But you had doing the ringside commentary was Gorilla Monsoon and of course Pat Patterson. Let me tell you, I'm gonna tell you, Vinny. That was the big impression and everything. But no one knew when they were watching that match what was about to happen to pro wrestling. They just saw Iron Sheik, you know, representing, you know, an enemy at that time, Iran, defeating the All-American boy. But nobody knew what was about to happen. How many months after that was it before Hulk Hogan beat him and got the title?
It was only 1 month. And
one
in
month.
Fact, most of the wrestlers themselves didn't know
right.
what was going to happen. I mean, Bob Backlund didn't know that what was going to happen when he lost to the Iron Sheik. So Vince McMahon Jr. kept the Hulk Hogan plan pretty tightly under wraps. And I think when Hulk Hogan first appeared right after that event at the end of 1983, the boys, the wrestlers, people knew without knowing for sure, like, okay, this is probably, he's probably going to win very soon because he probably wouldn't come into the company if he wasn't going to win the championship.
Was that
so they could see the writing on the wall, but it wasn't like there was a meeting called where Vince said, okay, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, he probably didn't do that. But you have to think, though, McMahon being as smart as he is, and certainly back then and forward thinking, maybe saw Hogan in Rocky III and said, I need that action. I need this in the WWF.
Yeah, in the book I go into that, how he had worked with Hogan before and then how he started planting the seeds in 1983 through this elaborate plan where he got a newspaper editor and photographer to come work for him to start a magazine, but then also use them to go send messages covertly to other wrestlers in other territories like Hulk Hogan to tell them to give him a call. Right. So there's this whole backstory that's just, you know, incredible to look back on and to see how Vince very secretly went about recruiting Hulk Hogan and building the pieces of this empire that he built.
And people who live today, I mean, we're all alive, I guess. But what I'm saying is, if you don't have to wait on news, everything news is served to you. And thanks to algorithms, it knows what you like and it serves everything up. But nobody knew. I didn't know why Lou Albano was in a Cyndi Lauper video. I didn't know. I had no clue. And I'm like, well, that's Lou Albano, so I'm going to like Cyndi Lauper. So it worked in that way, too. But those steps, just you can go back and look at the early 80s, the Hogan becoming champion, and then people getting involved in rock music, and then WrestleMania coming shortly thereafter, and just watching it explode. It was so exciting to be there. and also to watch, you know, because every Saturday and Sunday or whatever, I would check in on what was going on in the South, watching NWA. I'm in Atlanta now, so it's a completely different scene, and that's all gone. But to watch that sort of evolve too, and eventually meld with Vince McMahon's organization, it was quite a time. And
That whole period of expansion and conflict and battles between the WWF and the NWA, and it's a fascinating story of capitalism, of competition, of this whole industry that is really revolutionized within 5 to 10 years, and of course we know later on we get the WCW thing and all the way to the present, and now we have WWE dominating, but AEW, another organization that's trying to challenge them. So the story continues.
It's I think it's always going to be around. I mean, boxing, not so much. I mean, boxing is now an exhibition sport. I mean, that's how you get the word out about boxing. You see that Mike Tyson is going to fight Jake Logan. And in MMA, I think, is taking the place as far as boxing goes. But the thing I like about wrestling when I do watch it is it still has that showmanship that we're actors, but we're putting on a... have you ever seen the South Park where the kids don't ever wrestle? They just keep coming up with these crazy scenarios. Do you remember that episode?
No, I didn't see that.
Okay, so they have a backyard... The premise is they have a backyard wrestling thing going, and they don't really fight. They just keep coming up with more elaborate tales of what happened, and that's what brings the crowd there. And eventually McMahon shows up, and he wants to hire all of them. It's a fantastic it's take on it. But just to see that these guys still get out there and the legacy of a Roman Reigns, who was champion for a very long time. Again, spoiler alert, I mean, he's no longer the champion, right?
Well, yeah, and I was watching WrestleMania this weekend, and I was just thinking how it's, I think, to your point, part of its enduring popularity is because it borrows and takes from so many different types of media and performance art and does it all, right? So these entrances for these matches at WrestleMania, some of them were like 15 minutes long. So yeah. It's almost like a pop music concert, and then it's a Broadway show, and then it's a sporting event, and then it's stunt work. It's a mashup of different types, different genres of entertainment that just keeps you riveted. And it's also, it's rooted in storytelling. It's
yes.
The same way that a movie is.
Yes.
And so, I've always thought it was silly in the old days when people would have the debates over whether it was real or not, because to me, it was like no one came out of a Star Wars movie and said, oh, was that fake?
Right.
It's a silly thing to even talk about.
Right. It's my grandfather, I remember, because once I discovered it, I had to watch it every Saturday and stuff. And I'd put it on and my grandfather would go, why are you watching that, Timmy? That's fake. And my grandmother would look at him and go, it's no faker than when you watched it in the 50s. And he would just be quiet after that.
Right.
And I don't know a lot about that era, but can we go back and talk a little bit more about Iron Sheik? Because like that's really how this got started for you. Is you met him and you were going to write his biography, but then he took a turn. And if wrestling fans have seen the biographies, and people in Atlanta know him because he lived in Fayetteville. So he came on our show. One particular question I want to ask you is you sort of touch on it a little bit in the book. Do you think that his appearances on Stern Show were exploitative in a way?
I think so. I think that, he was a willing participant, so it doesn't mean that he's absolved of any responsibility for all that. But
right.
I think at that point in his life, you're talking about a guy that's severely traumatized by the murder of his oldest daughter and in severe grip of addiction to hard drugs.
Yes.
Without any real understanding of what he can do in his career besides that's something wrestling related. And he's being surrounded by people that are kind of winding him up and wanting him to, to dance for them. And
yeah.
Based on you have to remember these wrestlers, they get addicted to the spotlight and the affirmation and validation they get when people cheer them or like something that they do. and they're entertainers. They're, you know, at their heart. And so when all of that started, because he went off on some rant on a shoot interview about Brian Blair and other people that was just full of all this language, and it was just, you know, kind of unhinged. And everyone ate that up and loved it and said, do more, do more. And so he just said, okay, well, this is my meal ticket. And so I think he knew how to play it up. But I do think I never liked when I was watching all that. I never liked it. I never thought it was particularly entertaining or anything. I mean, it was entertaining initially, but it got old really quickly.
Really quickly. Yeah, really quick. Like having George Takei on there and saying, I mean, it wears out quickly, like you said. And you know, but he obviously didn't swear on terrestrial radio, but he would get, you know, yelly and stuff, but we kept him calm. There was another guy in town who called himself the Sheik. I think you talk about him in the book, but I don't remember what his name was. He was just the Sheik, and he would show up to events. Are you familiar with a guy that called himself that?
Well, there's the original Sheik, Ed Farhat, who was a very legendary, famous promoter out of Detroit. That may be somebody different than what you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, it was just a guy that was down here all the time.
I see. I think also with that whole thing, it was a little bit sad to me because Khosrow Vaziri, as I tried to portray in the book, was a very serious, very dedicated, very hardworking, very disciplined young man who took his craft so seriously. And so the juxtaposition between that person, the Khosrow Vaziri, that was so dedicated to his training and cared so much about good manners and civility, you know, raising his daughters. And I talk about this word in Persian, Javan Mardi, which is about a sense of chivalry. And that was like his thing. That was so important to him. So to see this other version of him be the exact opposite was just sad. And I never believed that was truly who he is.
Yeah. Sorry, I got to pause for 1 second. I'm sorry. Hang on.
Yeah.
All right. Now we can pick back up. So where do you see this book landing in the canon of Iron Sheik? There was a documentary, I guess, what is it, about 10, 12 years ago now about him. Did you ever speak with those guys, the guys who followed him around, they ran his Twitter or something for the longest time?
I did. So they're in the book towards the end.
Yeah.
They were at the funeral, and I had been in Fayetteville shortly before they had begun that whole project. So I think they did a good job with that project. I think that the difference is that a book and a documentary or film are just intrinsically different things.
Yes.
And I think that we have some similarity in the messages, excuse me, of these products, but a book, yeah, you know, I always feel very flattered when someone tells me that they read my book, because that means they spent maybe 9 or 10 hours on something that I worked on. Whereas a song is 3.5 minutes or a movie is 2 hours, a TV show, maybe 40 minutes. So it's a different, and it's why it's harder commercially to sell books, because not as many people read, and it's not, you know, we have a short attention spans nowadays. So it's a different type of thing, but I really am grateful when people take the time to sit down with it. And I think I think if I did my job, you'll walk away from it with a good feeling about who these people are, you know, and how relatable they are.
Yeah, and I think this is a great wrestling town. So, you know, obviously that's where Ted Turner and the WCW was for the longest time, and before that the NWA. But I know a lot of people that do it. In fact, just to be honest, I bought the audiobook. Your publisher sent me the paperback preview, then I got the hardback. And
right.
I said, I know me. I know how I am. I got to have the audiobook, which I believe you narrate, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I picked up on something as when you're speaking in the voice of somebody else, you kind of do an impression and capture the way they speak, you know, the pattern that they speak. I don't know, and I wanted to ask you, is that intentional or is that just something you do?
No, that was intentional in that. Well, I mean, when you read an audiobook, you have to somehow distinguish between the two voices when you're doing dialogue. So I had to do that. But then I think with someone like the Iron Sheik, he had a distinct way of speaking, and I didn't want to make a caricature out of that, but I wanted to just sort of subtly show that difference. And so, I'm certainly not a voice actor, and
but it was
great.
I have
a lot of respect for those people that do that, but I tried to do some of that in there.
It kind of eluded me until you started talking like Vince McMahon, and even if
oh, right.
even though but you didn't like it, it's not his voice, but it's his speech patterns and a little bit of his accent. It's perfect. So yeah, you are a voice actor. So take away.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, let's talk about it again here. Real quick reset. Brad Baluchian, the name of the book is The Six Pack, On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania, talking about Iron Sheik and as many wrestlers as you could find that were there the night he took the title from Bob Backlund. It's a great book. It's a fun read. There's a lot of history in there. There's stuff you may not learn. There's stuff you may not have known. And that's, you can watch 100 different documentaries about your favorite wrestler over the years or league or whatever. There's always something new to learn. And I learned some new things from reading your book, Brad. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it. Is there anything you'd like to say before we wrap up? Where can people find you? Where can people find the book?
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on. You mentioned documentaries, and there's such a glut of documentaries these days about wrestling, many of them very good. That I hope people will see this as a nice complement to that. It's, again, it's a different thing than a documentary, this narrative nonfiction book. So I hope they'll check it out. I also have a website, or it's a new online magazine at thebradpack.com, which has all this bonus content from the book. So I was only able to fit a limited amount of the material that I collected into the book, but I have all this additional material that I would think people will enjoy. So they can check that out at thebradpack.com. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope people will give it a look.
I think they will. It's, again, out there for the audience listening and for the wrestling fans listening. There's personalizations from Brad in there. It's kind of a narrative about how he became part of the fanhood. And I don't want to say easy read, because that makes it sound like it's not a smart book. But what I mean is that it's an easy tale to follow, and it's an interesting tale, and you've told it very well. So thank you for joining me, and best of luck. You got to have more books in you. What's next?
Well, I hope so. I mean, again, it really depends. If this book can do well enough, then I'll have an opportunity to do another one. In the meantime, I'm just going to do some shorter things relating to sports nostalgia, wrestling nostalgia, through my website and through shorter writing. But we'll see if I can get a third one and make it into a trilogy.
Do it, and then come back on, and we'll talk about it.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim.